This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Nellie Bailey. My co-host Glenn Ford is traveling. Coming up, a prominent economist says pay no attention to all this talk about recovery. And there's a war going on against Black people, and some of us are on the wrong side. But first, President Obama went on The Daily Show recently when he seemed to claim he wants to curb the powers of the president to lock up Americans and assassinate people overseas. But Kevin Goestola, a reporter for the influential website Fire Dog Lake, says Obama's plans are precisely the opposite.
I found it to be completely pathetic. One, just from a very conventional point of view, as I noted, he started to talk about establishing this legal structure in his second term as if he was having drinks with Jon Stewart. And I thought, well, you know, doesn't this country have one already? We happen to have a constitution, so we really don't need to form another additional legal structure that is probably going to be as pathetic as the second-class legal system that has been set up at Guantanamo Bay for those prisoners to go through and to not actually have justice. And so what came through in his suggestion of this alternative structure was that he really doesn't want to submit his presidency to the Constitution. He doesn't want it to be constricted. In fact, he has gone into courts and argued state secrets privilege so that the government would not be held accountable for warrantless wiretapping, for torture, or for FBI agents going into mosques and infiltrating communities. This is something that's happened routinely. So his answer, and Jon Stewart asked him, people have looked at you and you've continued Bush administration policies, and he named warrantless wiretapping. Well, Obama's answer seemed to be a complete dodge, a complete getaway. In fact, he did not really answer the question. Instead, he decided to point out a joke that Jon Stewart had flashed on the screen by doing a pun on the popular novel that has become a cultural sensation, The 50 Shades of Grey. And Jon Stewart has said, you have 50 shades of surveillance as president. And so Obama used this as an escape. And I just found this remarkable that he does not take it seriously that he has continued Bush national security policy.
Yes, in fact, President Bush said that all of these steps that he took were based on the inherent powers of the presidency, the same powers that President Obama is claiming.
Correct. And in fact, I'm familiar with the Black Agenda Report, and I know that you have covered this extensively. At Fire Dog Lake, we've covered this extensively. In fact, he's claimed and expanded a new power to assassinate and target people abroad. And I think that's incredibly critical. In fact, during this segment on Jon Stewart, he happened to claim that he was going after terrorists and abiding by international law and, in fact, American domestic law. Well, if you ask some of the top lawyers, civil liberties advocates, and human rights advocates in this country to answer to that, they would give you a litany of responses that would indicate that it is not clear that this new power claim to assassinate and target people abroad in zones that are not in areas that we have actually declared war, but are in zones like Somalia, Yemen, and Pakistan, where people are being executed, you know, every other week, it would seem. They would tell you that this is a new power, that this is something that people should be alarmed about. And Obama has a complete disregard for the effect of this expansion.
Now, he speaks of putting a new legal architecture in place. Well, he already has through his preventive detention bill. That is a legal architecture that goes beyond his interpretation, like Bush's interpretation, of the president's powers.
Yeah, I mean, if we're going to take it seriously, if we're not going to consider this to just be a flighty kind of proposal that he's floating on the Jon Stewart show, then it's true that there have been proposals that have been implemented, and they've just expanded the imperial presidency. And perhaps that is what he is indicating, giving us a preview of, that in his second term, he will further expand the power of the presidency so that Congress has absolutely no way to provide oversight, which is what the drone program is set up to do. It is out of reach of Congress. John Brennan, who presides over it, is not confirmed by the Senate. He helps to make decisions on who is killed, and there is absolutely little way that Congress can exercise oversight. So that is intentional. And I think that's part of what he's doing is putting these programs, the preventive detention, putting that in the military's hands, something he doesn't want the courts involved. He's fighting off a lawsuit against the NDAA right now that challenges this indefinite detention provision. And why? Because he thinks that the government should have this power.
Yes, and in that light, the president's remarks on the Jon Stewart show should be taken as a kind of threat that more is to come, as you say.
I think so. There's no other way to take it. And so anybody who is voting for this person has to understand that their vote is contributing to a person who is going to take office and will only expand the imperial presidency. Now, they may look at their options and contend to themselves that they have no choice but to vote for this individual, but I think they should just go in with no illusions and admit to themselves that they are voting for somebody who is an imperialist who is going to expand the presidency further.
And yet the spin he puts on that statement is that he wants this new architecture in order to protect the public from what some other new president might do.
Exactly. You won't find any truth coming out of the Obama campaign about what it would look like when Romney would set foot in the White House and would have this power to indefinitely detain citizens or would have this power to execute citizens abroad. You won't have truth talk coming from them about how Romney will only continue the sort of rendition and solitary confinement of people in Guantanamo prison that some prisoners, like Shakir Hammer, a British prisoner, says solitary confinement is way worse than Bush administration enhanced interrogation techniques. And he does not like being in prison under Obama. He would like the Bush days. So there is this fallacy I just want to briefly bring up, which is that Obama has not tortured any individuals and that Romney in power would bring that back. Well, in fact, you have prisoners who fear the Obama administration. You have prisoners who have died in Guantanamo Bay. So it is not the case that there is such this stark difference.
That was Kevin Goztola of FireDogLake.com. The People's Organization for Progress in Newark, New Jersey, possibly the hardest working black grassroots organization in the country, is gearing up for a march for jobs, economic justice, and peace on November 13th. PUP, as it is known, completed a 381-day marathon of daily demonstrations for jobs and social justice in July, but has continued almost daily street actions ever since. PUP's chairman, Larry Ham, says activists need to keep up the pressure, no matter who is in the White House.
I'm going to vote for the president, but at the same time, I propose to the organization that we have this demonstration immediately after the election to let people know we got to put the pressure back on. Because whether Obama's in the White House or whether Romney's in the White House, policies are going to come out of the White House that will be antithetical to the interests of working and poor people and people of color in this country. And unless we fight back, it's not going to change.
I'm sure you watched the debates, and so did your very political PUP members. Did you see any reflection of the concerns of people in Newark in those debates?
I think one of the things that really came out during the debates is how similar Romney and the president are on issues. I mean, how many times did Romney say he agreed with the president? So there's a lot of similarity. That's why it's a shame that third-party candidates are excluded from these debates, because there's another perspective that needs to be heard. For instance, I mean, they talk about Obamacare, but no one talks about the need for universal health care. The polls show a majority of the country would be in favor of, you know, Medicare for all. No discussion about that. And then there was the whole question of the economy and the economic system. Both candidates relegated themselves to talking about specific policies, but not once in the entire debate did you hear anybody talk about how our economic system functions and how our economic system and the way it functions leads to some of these very pressing problems that are confronting us today. There was no critique whatsoever. Romney would rattle off statistics or criticisms concerning number of people that are unemployed, the number of people that live in poverty, as if there were no unemployed people or no one living in poverty before President Obama came into office. And at the same time, President Obama would never go beyond saying our economic system is the greatest economic system in the world. A lot of people, even Americans, would question that, because many Americans are acutely aware at this point that America is no longer number one in terms of the quality of life it offers its citizens. We're no longer number one in terms of wages, hours, and benefits that workers receive. We're like down like number 20, number 18, 17. So that's why it would have been good to have third parties included, even though I know that they probably don't have a good chance of winning, but it would have been good to hear another perspective on these problems that face the country today.
I've heard you speak many times, Larry Ham, and your perspective sounds like that third-party perspective.
Well, it probably does. And this is the real conundrum that we wrestle with in the People's Organization for Progress. The People's Organization for Progress is not a political party. It's a mass organization. And it has in it people of different political ideologies. You know, we got some people who are what we call leftists. Some might even be called communists and socialists. We got some people that would be called Democrats. And one or two of them might call themselves Republicans. I don't know. Pan-Africanists and black nationalists. Just all kind of perspectives, you know, Christians and Muslims. Just about all the tendencies that are in the black community are reflected in the People's Organization for Progress. So we wrestle with this question of the contradiction between what it is we want and how it is to be achieved. How do we get from where we are now to where we want to be? In reality, Obama is the chief representative of U.S. imperialism. He's the commander-in-chief of the United States. The United States of America is the epicenter of worldwide imperialism, and Obama is its chief spokesperson. But at the same time, we wrestle with this question of racism, that a lot of the opposition toward President Obama is racist opposition. It really doesn't have anything to do with his policy. It has to do with his skin color. And how they met the day after he was elected, said, we're going to make him a one-term president, period. You know, how there have been so many death threats on his life. They have people on trial right now in Atlanta for planning an assassination plot. And they killed somebody in the process, too. This president has probably been more defamed than any other president in recent history. And the fact of the matter is that our base is the black community, you know, and working people. And the fact remains is that probably 95% of black people are going to vote for President Obama. All the leadership of all the labor unions in our area, you know, I'm talking about New Jersey right now, they're all supporting President Obama. So you got the black community and labor, two groups that we profess to try to represent. They're going in one direction, and yet we have a critique that points in another direction. So we have to wrestle with the resolution of that contradiction. I guess that's how, in one way, many of us can say we're voting for President Obama, but at the same time, 7 days later, we're saying we got to demonstrate. We have to. There's not going to be any change unless the people mobilize in large numbers. I mean, we're facing now conditions. I haven't seen conditions as bad as I've seen in our community in the last, I can't even remember it being like this. I can't remember a time in the course of one day encountering so many people begging for money and for food. You can't go to a fast food restaurant in New York. People literally stand at the menu board and wait for you to pull up so that they can ask you for money. And a lot of times they don't even ask for money. They ask you, would you please buy me something to eat? They're at the fast food restaurants. They're at the post office. They're at the gas station. Our streets are literally filling up with people begging to stay alive. And nobody's talking about that. I mean, this is one of the major shortcomings of these political debates, you know, in an effort to try to win these undecided white voters, because that's who they are. They're primarily whites who are undecided. They poll the black community. And for the first time in the history of polling, you know, the Republicans had 0% support. Even Bush had a little few percentage of people that said they might vote for him. These issues, these problems that we face are the result of how our economy functions. It's not just a question of who's in the White House. It's a question of the kind of economic system we have, an economic system that produces poverty, that produces conflict, that produces war, that produces unemployment. And until we come to grips with the fact that we have to change the economy in order to rid ourselves of these problems, we're going to continue to face these problems. We're going to continue to have this discussion that we're having right now. It's very discouraging that we come to this point every 4 years. Every national election becomes a repeat of the election before it. The fact that in 40 years since the Black Power movement, we have not been able to build any alternative political vehicle, and no one even has offered a strategy. There's much more that needs to be done in terms of increasing the power of working people and poor people. There's much more that needs to be done than simply forming a third party. We could form as many parties as we want, but the whole system is rigged against third party. There are a whole series of legal reforms that we would have to press for and realize before third parties would even have a chance of contending for power in this country. And no one has really put forward a strategy for making that happen. So until that happens, until we have a strategy, until we actually have alternative political vehicles that actually have some power, that can actually muster some votes and mobilize people to the polls in significant numbers, until that happens, we're just going to have this passion play every 4 years. You know, it's our own version of the crucifixion of Christ. Every 4 years, we go through the same situation, you know, choosing the lesser of two evils. But it'll keep happening until we put something other up on the board that can really contend for power.
That was Larry Hamm of People's Organization for Progress in Newark, New Jersey. President Obama has largely relied on the Federal Reserve to tinker with the ailing economy, rather than calling for direct creation of jobs as President Franklin Roosevelt did in the 1930s. Why the emphasis on the Federal Reserve? Noted economist Dr. Richard Wolff says big business and the banks prefer it that way.
In the history of the Keynesian economics that came out of the Great Depression of the 1930s, an article of faith that was believed by most members of the economic profession went like this. Yes, capitalism is extraordinarily unstable. Yes, periodically, its cycles can have a downturn that is really bad, hurts huge numbers of people, and lasts for years. But we shouldn't worry about that because we now have monetary and fiscal policies that we can throw at any impending downturn to make sure that it is short-lived on the one hand, and shallow is the word they use. That is, it doesn't hurt too many people, and then we'll get through it, and so we don't have to worry the way we used to. Second point, the one out of those two, monetary and fiscal policies, that were always preferred were the monetary policy. And the reason for that is simple. A fiscal policy is a policy that affects who the government spends money on and how much it spends, and who it takes money from and how it gets it. And therefore, it has to do, in the end, with the question of who pays taxes, how is the government going to raise money. And in a democratic society, even one as nearly formally democratic as ours, there's always the risk when fiscal policy comes into play that the mass of people will want the government to spend a lot of money to get us out of the economic crisis, and to get that money by taxing corporations and the rich. So opposed are the corporations and the rich to being made to pay for the economic crisis that in the end they're more responsible for than anybody else, that they have created a bias such that politicians have come to understand, try not to use fiscal policy. When you do, make it as short-lived as possible, and keep the focus on monetary policy. Try to make it all about how to use the Federal Reserve, which is our monetary authority, to print money, to manipulate interest rates, and so on. Because when that happens, there's no direct threat that the taxes may flow to impose on corporations and the rich, because of the old traditional arguments that they're the ones who have most of the money, they're the ones who've done the best over recent years, and therefore they're the ones who ought to be made to pay the lion's share of a crisis which, after all, they helped to bring about more than anybody else. So there's always been a bias on the Federal Reserve. What is a little bit unusual, or maybe not so little bit these days, is that the power of corporations and the rich in the halls of the presidency and of the Congress is so overwhelming that basically there isn't much in the way of a stimulus. There isn't much compared to the size of our problem that Bush was willing to do in the last year, year and a half of his administration, or that the Obama administration had been willing to do. Nothing, for example, on the scale of the fiscal policies of the 1930s. So we've had, for example, no federal jobs program whatsoever, where the federal government hires people to do socially useful things as a way of bringing down unemployment. There's been not only no creation of Social Security the way Roosevelt did in the 30s, but actually only discussion of how to cut Social Security, et cetera, et cetera. So we've seen no significant fiscal stimulus beyond what was done way back in 2009. No more real stimulus or very limited one, and everything has been focused, as your question points out, on monetary policy. And the uniqueness there is a stunning amount of monetary creation measured in the trillions of dollars, a stunning low level of interest rates kept low by the Federal Reserve at levels we've never seen before, let alone lasting this long, and finally, buying securities that are not just obligations of the United States government, which is the normal security that the Federal Reserve buys and sells, but now directly buying a privately produced mortgage-backed securities in a desperate attempt to shore up the balance sheets of corporations that are stuffed with these securities that were issued too quickly, that are not properly backed, that are losing value, that are threatened by the uncertain situation of our economy in general and of our housing market in particular. So the bottom line is, yes, we have an unprecedented focus on that kind of policy that does not threaten corporations and the rich. And we're on what's called QE3, quantitative easing number 3, simply because the first two quantitative easings, and that's just a fancy phrase for the massive creation of money by the Federal Reserve and the use of that money to shore up banks. We have quantitative easing 3 now because quantitative easings 1 and 2 failed to do much. That's why we're in the fifth year of an economic crisis, because the refusal to tax corporations and the rich, which is a political decision and not governed by any economic logic, is so powerful that we will keep subsidizing banks, which they're happy to do, makes money for them, on the theory that sooner or later, and now it's becoming clear that it's later, this will work its way down, a kind of trickle-down idea, to get this economy going again. And even though it hasn't worked three times now. And even though the crisis keeps lingering and the prognosis for 2013 is an economic downturn from what we have in 2012, there's no change on the horizon, at least not as far as either Mr. Romney or Mr. Obama have given the slightest indication they're even considering.
Some of us have great difficulty figuring out where the Federal Reserve ends and Wall Street begins. Banks can line up at a window, figuratively, and get virtually free money in the trillions of dollars. That amounts to a stimulus, although there has been no stimulus for the general economy since 2009.
Right. The Federal Reserve is there to do that. It is created as a way to get coordination among banks when there isn't a crisis, and to step in with massive subsidies, loans, you name it, to offset or prevent a crisis. And it's absolutely unprecedented. In 2008, 9, and 10, and some of this is continuing, but in those years in particular, trillions of dollars were paid out in loans of all kinds to all the major banks in the United States. Americans do not understand that over the last 3 or 4 years, we have basically nationalized or socialized our banking system. We've done it in a peculiar way, that is, we've allowed them to continue as private enterprises with private shareholders and privately selected boards of directors. But they are institutions utterly and completely dependent on government supports from a governmental agency that exists under the laws of the United States, specifying that it is there, quote unquote, for the well-being of all Americans. But it has chosen to pursue that well-being during a crisis by helping first and foremost the survival of these private banks. In other societies and at other times, any such massive public support of institutions who everyone knows would have collapsed the way Lehman Brothers did without that support, every other situation, one would have expected and demanded that these private institutions, having been saved by the government and by the people's money, one way or another, would owe something in return, would have to become partly owned, for example, by the government, so that when, if and when they return to profitability, the government that had saved them and had taken considerable risk to do so and had avoided helping the mass of people, choosing to help the banks instead, that there would have to be some massive payback. We did nothing of the sort. In most cases, we made the loans at historically unprecedented low rates. When we invested, when the Federal Reserve took positions in these banks, it agreed that these would be non-voting positions, so that even if they invested in the bank, they would not become part owners, etc. Extraordinary steps that validate the argument that the Federal Reserve is an extension of the big banks that exist in the United States and exists to coordinate among them when times are good and to save them with the public money and the public authority when they get themselves into trouble, which they do every few years because of the system's fundamental instability. And if people find that to be extraordinarily imbalanced and undemocratic, that's exactly right. That's what it is. That's what the system was set up to do. And that's what it's doing now. And you're right, it's an unprecedented level of that. But that reflects the fact that we are in the worst economic downturn in the last 75 years, and there's no end in sight.
To an observer, the question becomes, who owns who? It appears that the good faith and credit of the people, of the government, of the United States, is an asset of the banks.
Absolutely. And you can see it also in the most dramatic way by the fluid game of musical chairs, in the sense that the people who rise up through the private banking sector are the ones who end up becoming members of the 12 regional Federal Reserve Bank boards, and that in turn, the president of those regional 12 regions make up the Board of Governors, as they're called in Washington. So yes, it is a very cozy a relationship in which all of the major players at the top know each other, probably have been working together for decades in the leading banks of the United States, et cetera, et cetera. So, yes, it is very much a bankers' club, a bankers' association, and it is a sign that this is an economic system which not only allows the financial sector to have an enormous role to play in this economic system and in its instabilities, but gives it a kind of veto power, a crucial position, so that when it causes economic downturns, especially bad ones like today, it is in the driver's seat to coordinate with the government the use of all of its authority and all of its wealth, both the taxing wealth that it has and the wealth that comes from being the monopoly of printing money, to make sure that its way of organizing this economy, a very concentrated, top-down, hierarchical capitalism, is what gets preserved first and foremost. Now, here's a statistic to drive it all home. On the 16th of October, the Bureau of Labor Statistics in Washington issued its regular press release about real wages. And it's a short press release, but about halfway through it is a stunning statistic. They measure the real wages, that's the money earned by American workers adjusted for the prices they have to pay. The real wages of American workers dropped by 2.4%. from October of 2010 to the current October 2012. Well, that is a stunning reality, because the last 2 years have been the years where the pundits and the politicians have tried to suggest that we are on or on the road to or in the way of a quote-unquote recovery. And indeed, for bank profits and for the stock market and for corporate profits, it has been a good period of time. But no statistic could more dramatically show what this so-called recovery has been as an experience for the mass of American workers. The average real wage dropped by 2.4%. Well, 2.4% is 1 week out of 52. It basically means that over the last 2 years, workers in America got the right to work one of the weeks of the year for absolutely no pay at all, compared to what they were getting 2 years ago. It is bad news for the mass of people. It is bad news for the long-term viability of the American economy, because people who lose real wages are people who can't buy what they bought before. If you add to that that banks are less and less willing to lend to Americans because Americans can't pay back, when the savings of Americans are trying to be built up because hard times frighten people, you're talking about a long-term decline prospect for the American economy that is the mirror opposite of any facile talk about a recovery.
Dr. Richard Wolff is Professor Emeritus of Economics at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. In Chicago, a recently concluded summit meeting on saving the African American child called for the creation of a national black education agenda. Dr. Donald Smith gave the keynote address for the summit. He says the delegates share a fundamental premise.
That our kids need both academic excellence and cultural excellence. That cultural excellence is a cementing principle that holds everything else together for us. And that's what our schools are not teaching. That's what our schools of education are not teaching. And certainly that is not what our president and the federal government want to happen. But we've got to do it to keep ourselves together. The population in the United States is greatly changing, and within the next 10 years, people of color will be the majority in the United States, beginning with Latinos, then followed by African Americans, Asians, and Native Americans. And accordingly, groups of planners have been thinking for some time, white groups, white think tanks have been planning, how do we keep control when we are no longer the majority. And one of the principal means of control is the education system. And so the system of education has always been lacking, has always been negative in terms of the education of people of African ancestry. But now a foreign company from Great Britain called Pearson has been engaged by most of the major school systems in this country to create curriculum, to create the testing, to create teacher certification. So that's one of the main ways that the majority, becoming the new minority, will keep control, is through education. So I think we made that point very clearly. The second point that we made is that not only education, but movies, television, commercials will also be geared in terms of keeping that control of white people. I mentioned in my own talk that a major factor is the birth control. Mitt Romney and most white politicians, most white men, are very much opposed to a woman's right to choose because they know that every white baby aborted makes the turnover of the population that much more evident and closer. So people were talking about these issues throughout the summit. So I think we did make an impression. Now, what we hope will occur is that as a result of this summit in Chicago, we will be able to develop regional organizations of the National Black Education Agenda, regional and local organizations. So we're about this now. Of course, we're going to have to fundraise because we don't have any money. Everything came out of our own pockets to put on this summit. So we're going to need funds to be able to establish these regional organizations that will promulgate black academic and cultural excellence, and also local organizations.
And you had this meeting in Chicago, which has been a kind of laboratory for the so-called school reform movement.
That is absolutely correct. I pointed out, and it was very interesting, almost at the moment I was speaking in Chicago about the CEO of the public schools, a man named Jean-Claude Brossard, he was being fired. Jean-Claude Brossard is a graduate of the Broad Superintendents Institute. The Broad Institute is backed by the billionaire Broad family. What they do is they pinpoint black and Hispanic educators, or they don't even have to have had education experience. They've had business experience. They bring them to this institute, they give them conservative training, and then they send them out to head school systems. And that's what Jean-Claude Brossard was. Prior to coming to Chicago, he was superintendent in Rochester, New York. But the community kicked him out of there. And Rahm Emanuel, who cares nothing about our people, engaged him as the superintendent, as the CEO in Chicago. Well, he was fired. Now, the person who now replaces him, Barbara Bird Bennett, was a failed superintendent in Cleveland and Detroit, and she was a trainer for the Broad Institute. She now is the head of education in Chicago. So not only will the school system continue to be the pipeline to the prisons, but our young people who are not taught to care about themselves, to care about each other, are going to continue to kill each other on the streets. And that is one of the great tragedies of our community, of our experience, that our young people in New York and Detroit and Chicago, Atlanta, Los Angeles are killing each other because they don't care about each other. They haven't been taught to care about each other.
And in Chicago, we have the long, tall shadow cast by Arne Duncan, who used to be the CEO of Chicago Schools and now is Obama's Secretary of Education.
Well, I made that point in my talk, that of many bad things that the president has done to us, and he is a champion of charter schools, the worst thing he has done to us was to name Arne Duncan as the Secretary of Education. Your listeners will recall that Arne Duncan, about 2 years ago, made the statement that the best thing that could have happened to the New Orleans schools was Katrina. Could you imagine that, his saying that? And as a result of Katrina and the reorganization of the New Orleans schools, they're now primarily charter schools. which are controlled by corporations. And you know the corporations don't want schools teaching our people or any people to be critical thinkers. All the corporations want is the training of people so that people can keep the wheels of industry going.
I just read recently that Chicago's schools in 1995, the teaching staff was 45% black, and that today
and now
that figure is 19%.
Is 19%. And if one looks for a black male, it's like finding a needle in a haystack.
And is this the legacy of the so-called reform movement?
Oh, it is indeed, yes. But it isn't just Chicago. Chicago is the epitome of the worst that's happening to our kids in the public schools. But that's happening in New York City, that's happening in Atlanta, Dallas, L.A., San Francisco, throughout the country. And we are at a point of crisis in education because, as I pointed earlier in this conversation, because of the turnover of the population. People of color are going to be the majority population. So the white minority have already planned how they will keep control. The education system is going to be the major focus.
So we're going to have an overwhelmingly people of color public school population taught by an overwhelmingly white teaching staff.
Absolutely. A teaching staff that by and large has not been trained about the history and culture of our people. And something else, at the time that I became a teacher, some 50 years ago, people going into the teaching profession, by and large, were people with excellent training. Now, those who go into the teaching profession rarely are outstanding students themselves. The teaching profession is mostly white and mostly mediocre, and that's tragic.
And we're looking at these teacher mills like Teach for America, which seem to have found favor with this administration.
What they do is they take promising college graduates and give them some basic training, like Army basic training, and then they go out into the schools and teach for a year or 2 years at most, and then they leave. And they use that as a credential to get themselves other well-paying jobs. They're not interested in staying in teaching. It is the rare Teach for America person who remains in teaching. It's just a stair step.
Well, what kind of country are we going to have in terms of education when we don't have a professional teaching force, when all of the veterans and the folks who dedicated their lives to education are weeded out in favor of these soon-to-be-gone young folks?
Well, let's talk about where the general student population is, not just simply students of color who are lagging behind. The United States lags behind all the other industrialized nations in mathematics, in science, and in language. So the education system in America is not serving any of the populations in ways that it provides excellence in instruction, and excellent outcomes. We're producing a mediocre population, and pretty soon the United States will be mediocre in terms of the kind of education it's giving its students.
Dr. Donald Smith, working on a national black education agenda. It's been 2 years since cholera was introduced into Haiti by United Nations occupation soldiers. A broad coalition of organizations is urging U.S. officials to put pressure on the U.N. to address the health crisis. We asked Dan Beaton of the Center for Economic and Policy Research what the so-called international community has done about the epidemic.
Well, not nearly enough. The cholera infections are down this year over last year, but there's still far too many people getting infected and far too many people dying. There's a total of 7,564 Haitians who have died from cholera. That's the most recent number I've seen. And over 600,000 have been infected in total, and that's just outrageous. And this is really avoidable. There's a couple of factors going on here. One is that NGOs have not been providing enough treatment and prevention for cholera in Haiti, and that's in turn largely due to a lack of funding. So this has not been a priority for the international community. Another thing is that the water and sanitation infrastructure in Haiti is lacking, and that's why cholera was able to get a foothold in the first place, and that's why it spread, and that's why it continues to be an epidemic. And the UN could help implement water and sanitation infrastructure that would contain this problem, eventually allow cholera to be eradicated for about the same cost of what it takes for the UN troops to stay in Haiti for 1 year, which is close to $1 billion. So it's definitely a doable solution if the international community actually wants to do it, but it just hasn't been a priority.
Why should we be talking about outside foreign NGOs providing the wherewithal for this and not the United Nations, which is culpable in this, providing the wherewithal to the Haitian government?
No, you're absolutely right, Glenn. The reason I mentioned the NGOs, though, is that they're there on the ground doing this work to start with. They have the cholera treatment centers. They have the treatment units and so on. They have people on the ground. So if they get more money, they can really roll and make things happen very quickly. You know, groups like Doctors Without Borders and Partners in Health and so on. But they haven't been getting the funding that they need from the international community. So that's one where the people who are, if you'll excuse the term, ready to implement shovel-ready projects, in a sense, to eradicate cholera, are not being funded to do that. The other thing is, you're absolutely right, in terms of a lasting solution to this problem, it is the UN's responsibility because they're the ones who caused it. And it's the international community's responsibility to make sure that the UN has the funding and dedicates that funding to taking care of this problem once and for all, and that's not happening.
And yet the UN has no problem extending for another year their occupation force, MINUSTAH.
No, that's right. And so, yeah, I'm not trying to let the UN off the hook at all. The UN continues to refuse to take responsibility for actually causing the epidemic. They will not really admit that ultimately they're the ones that brought it there, in a sense. There's been people affiliated with the UN, such as Bill Clinton, who've said, have admitted, yeah, it was UN troops who brought it in. But in terms of an institutional acceptance of that responsibility, that has not happened. And so that's really the first thing that needs to happen before the UN is going to step up to the plate and say, we need to take care of this. It's our fault. So absolutely, that's right. And so when they're not doing that, then it makes it easier for them to turn around and say, you know, we need to keep spending this money on having these troops in there. And why the troops are there, you know, is very unclear to just about anybody. There's no violent conflict in Haiti, and there hasn't been a threat of anything like that. Haiti's not at war with any other country, so there's no need for these people to be there in the first place. So, yeah, it's really misplaced priorities.
And we must ask, what good does this Bill Clinton person do? He was appointed the special UN envoy to Haiti. Lots of people call him the viceroy. And supposedly the rationale was that being a former U.S. president, he was close to that international community. That seems to be a code word to the rich countries and could get money funneled to the places that it's needed.
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, you're absolutely right. Former President Clinton could be doing a lot more to raise the money and to have it spent effectively. If he really wanted to run around and dream about cholera all the time, I think that things would get taken care of pretty quickly. But he's not doing that, unfortunately. You know, one of the good things that his office does do is they do track the money. You know, that's something I'll give them credit for. But, you know, again, he's partly responsible for there not being enough money raised to tackle the most urgent priorities, which definitely include the cholera epidemic.
And the state of casualties is actually unknown because Haiti's infrastructure is so diminished that you really can't trust the official figures.
No, that's right. I'm glad you made that point, because when I throw out those numbers like I did, that is an undercount. And it's partly due to that Haiti is a very rural country, and in the rural, remote areas, which are very inaccessible, much more inaccessible in Haiti than in a lot of other countries, just due to the fact that the roads are in such bad shape and it takes so long to get anywhere. It's very difficult to know exactly what the cholera incidence is like in those places. And it's also a factor in that people in some of these areas are more likely to die, unfortunately, if they do contract cholera, because they're going to have a much more difficult time getting treatment. So that's why there's a vast need to be able to have people doing the treatment and prevention all over the country, not just in the major urban areas. But, you know, again, it's just not really a priority for the international community.
Well, Bill Clinton's priority seems to be the development of Haiti's sweatshop labor capacity.
Well, it seems that that's what's going on with this industrial park. They've kind of taken on, I'm talking about both President Bill Clinton and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, have taken on as kind of a pet project, and they're really making a cornerstone of their joint Haiti policy, which is seeing this essentially what looks like a big complex for sweatshop jobs to be set up in northern Haiti. And Haiti's been down this road before. Jean-Claude Duvalier really pushed the apparel sector as kind of a cornerstone of his development policy for Haiti, and it really maxed out. And then aside from that, sweatshops are never ideal workplaces for anybody. It also reached a maximum employment, and there's just limits to how much that can do. I mean, certainly it wasn't a big development success in the 70s or 80s, or Haiti wouldn't be in such bad shape as it is now. So, you know, Haiti's seen this before, and it's certainly not going to live up to the hype.
That was Dan Beaton of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. At Black Agenda Report, we often criticize what we call the Black misleadership class, the folks in high positions who work against the interests of the masses of Black people. Bar Managing Editor Bruce Dixon has this commentary.
The late Kwame Ture used to say that there was a war in progress, a war against Black people, and that we seem to be the only ones who didn't know it. The war at the heart of today's Black polity has a similar character. It's a war between the Black elite, our own native class of African-American political and cultural misleaders, and the rest of us. And since that class of misleaders possesses near exclusive access to our Black pulpits, our newspapers, to the radio and TV stations most of us listen to, it's no surprise that only one side is awake and aware. Atlanta Mayor Kasim Reed is a rising star in Black Democratic political circles who enjoys the favor of big corporate donors like Home Depot, Sun Trust, and Bank of America because he is a tireless warrior against, not for, the interests of most Black people in Atlanta and around the nation. Reed is widely credited in corporate media like the Wall Street Journal for having solved the intractable problem of ballooning pensions for city workers, which they say threatened to bankrupt Atlanta. If there had been an actual Black press to explain this for us, the explanation would have went something like this. Generations of teachers, city, county, and state government workers, in their negotiations with bosses, and in Atlanta those have been Black mayors for the last 40 years, agreed in good faith to forego immediate wage increases now in favor of pensions and medical benefits in their retirement, which both they and their employers were to jointly pay for. But although cities, states, and school districts took the money out of workers' checks each month, they never felt obliged to keep their promise and pay their part of those pensions. To do so might have required higher taxes, especially on the wealthiest individuals and corporations who, over the last decades, have paid a lower and lower share of their wealth in taxes, while governments have been forced to borrow operating money from them at loan shark interest rates. This is the pattern followed by hundreds of U.S. cities and school districts, and probably by most of its states. Pension managers mostly said that not funding the pensions was okay because they could make smart enough investments to compensate for the money public employers were not putting into those pension funds. The crash of 2007 and 2008 made lots of their smart investments worthless. Now, big city mayors, governors, and school district execs are not about to go to the public and to the wealthy and say, since we didn't keep our promises all these years, we've got to tax you heavily to pay for these pensions that we know we should have been funding all along. Instead, they have to recast their broken promises as unfunded liabilities, and the retirement benefits previously agreed upon as excessive, greedy, and unsustainable. Atlanta's Kasim Reed has been a champion at this. Last year, the black mayor of Atlanta broke just about every pension promise made to Atlanta city workers by 40 years of black mayors and sharply limited retirement compensation of new city workers. In Atlanta, most of these city workers are African Americans. Reed now has his sights set on reducing the wages and pensions of Atlanta's 4,000 transit workers, perhaps as a prelude to privatization or a state takeover. If the targets here had been black contractors instead of black city and transit workers, there would be a storm of denunciations from black pulpits and pundits, from black newspapers and commentators. But since the spear chuckers in this war against ordinary black folks are our own black leadership class, those leaders are mostly silent. It's time to dismiss that whole class and raise up new leaders.
And that's it for this week's Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Greg Russ.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.